Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The TakeCast. My name is Davis Maddock. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Maddock. In this episode of the show, I'm joined by my buddy, Paul Villasmar. You might know him better as Pew Pew Pew. He is a professional daily fantasy soccer player. He actually was on the show kind of at the height of the pandemic about 10 months ago at this point, and we chatted about his career professionally playing poker, professionally playing DFS, soccer DFS, a lot of that stuff. So in this episode of the show, we preview the Champions League final that is coming up this weekend. We preview the European Championships in soccer that are coming up on June 12th, I believe, the day it starts. And also, of course, we had to talk about the crypto markets as well, because Paul is well-versed in those things. So hope that you guys find it interesting. Hope that you find some actionable stuff here. If you want to support the show, as always, bonus episodes on patreon.com/takecast. You can sign up for an account on Star Stock Market using the promo code DavisMatic. Get a free $10, no strings attached there. Or you can just leave a rating or review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, everyone. Welcoming Paul Villasmar back to the show. He actually came on with me, probably about 10 months ago at this point during hardcore lockdown quarantining pre-vaccine. It was during the summer. We talked about Paul's journey through poker and DFS and everything, and now we're meeting on much happier terms, Paul.
Yeah, I think it was 10 months ago. It was a weird place. It's still been pretty weird, but it's good little time span between.
Yeah. I mean, the world is, we're coming out on the other side. I mean, maybe a little bit too quickly. I don't know. It's hard to have an opinion, so here in the States, so Paul lives in Canada, but here in the States, basically we're opening back up, mask off. Now we have, I believe the most recent thing I read was that like 70% of American adults have gotten at least one dose of a vaccine, and if Canada is catching up pretty fast, that's right. Yeah,
we lagged really really poorly on our initial vaccine rollout, and we've caught up to the point that I think that our rate of vaccination has taken off, that we should be past the United States at least on one. I don't think our levels on people getting two vaccines is really poor. We still kind of haven't reached that yet, but hopefully we catch up quickly and we can have a summer. Cause right now we're pretty locked down in Ontario, like where I am.
Rob Ford says you guys can't even go golf, right?
Yeah. I think he said that, and then he retraced, and he was basically like, you can't even, go to the park. And I live like right beside a park, and everybody's going to the park. You know what I mean? Like,
it's just, right.
Rob Ford's kind of an idiot.
Yeah. I mean, that was what I did during last year, was I just golfed, because it was like, I can't, you're not going out to restaurants. You're not going to the movies. So if you want to get out and you're not going to the gym, you want to get out of the house and move around for a little bit, like golf was the savior. So I feel very blessed that I was able to do that. Did you pick up any new habits, or like, what was your big thing? Did you play a bunch of online cards? Like what did you do for the most part?
I didn't. And I think we were talking about poker, and I was
right
kind of close to getting back into it. And then DFS came back, and then crypto got a little bit more intense. And so, my new habit is probably, I haven't exercised anywhere near as much as I should. I've drank more.
Yeah, I feel like that was super common for a lot of people. Like a lot of people got into like just, you know, making cocktails and drinking wine and stuff. Like I know that that was a big thing for a lot of people joined like wine, like mailing lists and stuff. I saw that like subscription alcohol services kind of took off.
Yeah. I think it just, like I'm not like getting, but hammered or anything, but like, you know, I'm having at least like one drink, two drinks every day.
Right.
Always. And I feel like it's just, there's not as much stuff to do. Yeah, nothing really too crazy. I've been, and you know, the winters in Canada are pretty brutal anyways. So
right.
For the most part, you just stay inside and kind of hibernate anyways. I'm kind of looking forward to, I want to play some soccer, but I don't know if we're going to get to do that this summer. I really kind of fiend. I haven't played in over a year, so.
Yeah, that would be something I really wanted to do as well. There actually is like an indoor soccer place right by my house. Like I could walk there. It's like half a mile. Yeah. And I think they just opened up last week. I mean, I haven't played since college. We used to play like pickup soccer at the old football stadium at the college I went to. And that would be a blast. So that's a good reminder for me to look into that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've played my whole life and I still like would play. I was playing in like two leagues when I was in California and kind of like helping manage too. So I definitely miss that. And I'm getting to an age where like, you don't know how many years I have left before I just totally break down. So it's
right.
Kind of like a bummer that I can't play.
Yeah. So we're gonna chat about a bunch of stuff today. I want to take a look, at the Champions League final. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about the Europa League final because I actually think it's a pretty interesting game. And then I want to get kind of deep into Euro 2020/2021, and then we'll talk a little bit about crypto at the end of the show because it's a very interesting time in crypto, and you're a pretty knowledgeable guy. Also, very similar to me, I think, and very into Bitcoin for a long time and have become more sold on the Ethereum blockchain and Ethereum world. So I think all of that stuff will be good. So let's just get into it right now. Man City versus Chelsea. City is listed as a -115 favorite on the FanDuel Sportsbook. Regulation tie, +240. Chelsea, +340. They're playing this in Istanbul. Is that correct?
Yeah, did they switch it?
They've moved it at least once, and now I don't know where it's actually being played.
Yeah,
so
I thought that they were moving it to Wembley. I saw that they were talking about that. I can't remember. I think they did, which would make sense because if you can't have if Turkey is in the middle of a big outbreak and there's two British teams, it kind of makes sense.
So they,
I'm not sure.
You're right. So it was in Istanbul. Then they were going to do it in Wembley, and now they have moved it to Portugal. So they're playing it. They're playing it in Porto. So that is, I mean, you know, not that it really matters. I guess that there will be more fans there than there would have been had the final been played, you know, 2 months ago or whatever. Yeah. I don't imagine that it's going to be full of people. But you know, we have actually seen the last 2 weeks in the Premier League, like fans have totally made a difference on these games, which is, you know, obviously that's kind of one of those human intuition things where you're like, yeah, no shit, fans being there, it's going to be, you know, it goes from these guys feeling like they're practicing to actually playing. But it has been cool to see the games be a little bit different with fans there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just the atmosphere is a lot better. Players kind of, you can see like the emotion is a little bit higher. Yeah, it was nice because I kind of wasn't really thinking too much about it because we just got so used to not having fans that I've kind of started paying more attention to it because I think that not having fans did change it a little bit, right? I think it changed home team advantage a lot. It kind of adjusted and I need to adjust back probably because I do think that that's a key part to, you know, performance in soccer. I mean, a little bit, shouldn't overdo it, but I think that definitely this weekend, seeing the fans and seeing how players were celebrating, and especially on the last game of the weekend, I think it was definitely played a factor.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. So I actually have already bet this game. I bet City in regulation to win at -110. Now, I probably would have bet City anyways once again. So this game is being played this weekend on the 29th. And I probably would have bet City anyways, because, you know, obviously I'm going to be watching the game anyways. And I got to bet it. But the reason why I got reminded of the idea to go bet it was, what's the name? Edouard Mendy, the goalie for Chelsea, got injured on Sunday. And so they are putting Kepa back in goal. And he's just not any good. He can't stop shots. He's not great with the ball at his feet. Like, and it's one of the strangest things ever, because you really never notice goalies in a high level soccer game unless they do something bad. Like, you don't really realize all the great things that goalies do, or if they have, you know, some truly incredible save. And Kepa seems to be bad at mostly all of the big goaltending things. And I do actually think him being in there instead of Mendy is worth, you know, 10, 15 cents for Chelsea.
Yeah. I mean, Kepa stinks. It's kind of sad, I guess, because, you know, typically throughout soccer, goalies don't peak until later, right? Like, usually it's just a skill that takes a little bit more time.
Right.
And they tend to be, and he was really hyped up and was like, I think it was like the most expensive goalie ever. And, you know, Chelsea clearly overpaid and the hype was a little bit too high and he just had a bad run. And then I think it just got, you know, your confidence goes and you're doing that in front of, you know, thousands of fans, and it just kind of like spirals. And yeah, it sucks for him. I mean, I feel bad for the guy. But he's been bad. He's been real terrible.
So
real,
bad.
So bad, making so many mistakes. And they look a lot better with Mendy. But I did see that they're hopeful that Mendy will play. That that they think he could train on Wednesday, and that they're gonna hopeful that he's gonna play. So I think if he's fit, he'll be in there. I think it's better. But you know, I mean, look, Kepa, I don't know. Yeah. It's hard to say. I mean, he looked okay in the last few appearances he's had, and
right.
He just needed to be taken out of the limelight and just like, you need to just chill. I think he may end up being okay eventually. I think he was overhyped and he just needed to be, I think Chelsea.
Well, yeah, most expensive goalie ever. And still even two off seasons after, still the most expensive goalie ever. So
and he's super young, right? He's still very young.
Yeah. 25, I think still. So
oh, really? So yeah, no, he's not that young then, I guess. If he's 25.
Let me see. Yeah, 26 actually. But I mean, to your point though, 26 for a goalie, like, if as long as you are good about your fitness and not like, you could play until you're 35. It's kind of like quarterback that way.
Yeah. Like, for 26 for a soccer player is like, you're coming into your peak years. For goalie, I think it's a little later. Like, you tend to peak between like 28, 32, something like that. I want to say on average, but you know, yeah, at this point it's not great. And Mendy just looked a lot better. Performed a lot better.
Just in terms of there are a couple dominant storylines here. I think one, does Timo Werner start? Or do they start with Kai Havertz at kind of, you know, striker, false nine, and then you have him and Pulisic and Mount interchanging? Does Pep start with a striker, or does he start Foden or KDB, you know, with Mahrez and Bernardo Silva and have them interchange? I think that probably City will do that. They're not going to start with Aguero or Jesus, and that would be the plan B. Which, I, you know, far be it for me to doubt Pep, but doesn't this feel like a galaxy brain style thing for Pep, where he might get this wrong from the start? Because you just need to have, like, goals are so important. You know, so many Champions League finals, 0-0 going into 90 minutes, 1-1 going into 90 minutes, and, you know, what changes the game? Gareth Bale's overhead kick, right? Like, just someone who is on the field to score. You know, I don't know. I actually feel like they probably should start with Gabriel Jesus, even though he's like the 15th best player on that squad or whatever, just because of how it will force them to play. What do you think about that?
I think that, first of all, Pep is known for galaxy braining.
Yes.
In the Champions League. I always want to say, I think Pep's the best manager
ever.
Probably the best manager ever. But there definitely is an argument to say that he's probably overthought it a little bit in key moments in the Champions League at times. I think this time he's going to be a little bit more predictable. I think he's gone a little bit more predictable this year. I think he's changed his style a little bit to just kind of having like a go-to formation and lineup that they've gotten used to. And I think that he is most likely to stick with that, especially because he has not played Chelsea with that lineup, right? Like they played a couple weeks ago and they played like a complete left field.
Yeah, total like, B-side, basically.
Total B-side, basically. Total different formation. And you could see that Pep's kind of thinking, you know, chess-wise, he doesn't want to show his hand and they don't want to play against him like that. So I think they're better without Jesus and Aguero. I think for sure without Aguero.
Yes. Yeah. Aguero just doesn't have the legs anymore.
Yeah. I think Aguero. Yeah, exactly. I don't think Aguero has the legs. I think Jesus offers more defensively than Aguero. I think that they're going to want to go out and they're going to want to dominate possession. I think they're going to go out there and they're going to go head to head. I think this is the way that they're going to do it. And in that case, I think that he sticks to what he's been playing, which is a front three of basically like De Bruyne, Mahrez, and Foden, with kind of De Bruyne almost in a false nine switching. I think that's they've looked the best like that. I think they just control the game. Their defense is so much better now than it was like last year. Well, I remember we talked about City versus Liverpool last time, I remember.
And, right.
And since then, I think City has just – they've just really –
Yeah, Pep just figured out the defense. It's Ruben Dias and John Stones. Cancelo has given them great performances, and you know, Kyle Walker. They've gotten to the point to where actually, you know, it's better to have Cancelo in there. I actually don't think Cancelo is going to start though. I think they will start Kyle Walker here, even though Cancelo has been better, just because they want that defense. Like Pep's going to want the defensive solidity, and Kyle Walker is. He is the better defender. Cancelo is far better offensively, but Walker is, you know, it's rock solid back there.
I want to say that I think Walker starts for sure. I think it's more down to Zinchenko and Cancelo, with Cancelo on the opposite, which he's played a lot this year on the left.
Right. Yeah. Cause that's fits Pep's style of inverting the fullbacks anyway.
Yeah. I think Chelsea and City want to kind of control possession. I think, City is going to want to be dominant on possession. I think they always want to. And I think that they're really going to try to force Chelsea off the ball, which is not their strong suit. I think City has a much better chance of controlling the game and dominating possession than Chelsea does. And in that situation, you probably want to flood the midfield. And Zinchenko or Cancelo can both play as inverted fullbacks, kind of. And Cancelo has been amazing in terms of his positional sense this year, of like he basically has played like a central midfielder or a winger, and he can switch between the two. And then when you play with like Foden and Mahrez, they're both basically like guys that can play as central midfielders or wingers. So it really just kind of screws with you, because Mahrez can just chill out wide, or he can come outside. If you have Cancelo can do the same, can plug those holes. And Pep, who's kind of like the person who's perfected that kind of false nine system, really with the inverted fullbacks, it just changes everything, because it allows his central midfielders to basically play as a false nine and get in the box, which Gundogan and De Bruyne have done like amazingly well. And you're allowed that freedom if you basically can have a fullback that comes in and plugs those gaps. And Cancelo, Walker, and Zinchenko all do that really well. Mendy doesn't. He's kind of just bad, but the other guys.
Yeah, Mendy just wants to cross. Mendy just wants to get down the flank and cross. So I don't think he'll go there. Then I guess the other big question is, does Chelsea run with the Reece James Ben Chilwell pairing, or do they try and get a little bit of, because Marcus Alonso is very good offensively at getting in the box. He's really good on corners. What? Cause he's like 6'3". I think Chilwell will probably start. It'll be Jorginho and Kovacic in the midfield, and then a front three of Pulisic, Mount, and Werner, but I don't think they should start Timo Werner. I think they should start Kai Havertz, but I don't think that's their plan. I think it will be Werner. And I mean, you can just see it in your head already, right? Werner gets through clean. He's 8 yards from the net. He's got Ederson dead to rights and he scuffs it wide. Like you can see it playing through your mind right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think, Havertz is kind of coming back from an injury, I think, right? He hasn't been starting.
Yeah.
I think they're better with probably with Havertz there. I do think though, it probably makes more sense against City just from a how you set up standpoint to have Werner to be a little bit more counterattacking, right? Which he's got more pace and he's a little bit better on the break since you're probably not going to have as much possession.
And he can put pressure on the ball too. Like Havertz is kind of just, you know, I mean, not slow, but he doesn't cover as much ground. Timo is going to cover a bunch of ground.
Yeah, Havertz is more of a brain. He's more of a, you know, he's less of an athletic player. Doesn't pressure. I mean, he's fine. It's just that Werner is like a, you know, super athlete. And right. I mean, I think, you know, Werner just, he's so frustrating because dude, you're faster than everyone else. You don't need to be right on the line and be offside all the time. Like you can start your run a little bit later, pull a little bit back and you're going to be fine because you're going to beat most people for pace. Like you don't need to be right on the line. It's so frustrating. Like you don't need to be. And he is like so often he's offside and he just scuffs chances too much. I mean, I think he's a really good player and I like him and I think he's a good signing. I just think that he needs to kind of, I think he'll get it together and I think he'll be great, but I think he's just,
he's like every Chelsea showdown slate. I just play him in captain. Cause he's always like 40% owned, 9% owned, you know, he'll get a couple crosses in, he'll take 5 shots and, you know, like he still is at the top of like the expected goal charts and stuff, but he has 7 goals because his finishing has been really poor. But you know, whatever it happens. All right, real quick, I do want to take a look at the Europa League final because it is interesting because it's Man United against a team that is so defensively sound, and this is what they've struggled with all year. Is like if you let them on the counter, they're actually so good because Bruno is so good on the counter. Rashford is great on the counter. Edinson Cavani, who has been amazing for them, he's great on the counter. But they're going to have as much of the ball as they want against Villarreal. Villarreal will be the team soaking up the pressure and breaking. And I think United probably will get through because their players are so much better than Villarreal. I mean, United is like the most expensive squad in the world. You know, Pogba and Bruno and Rashford, it's like it's unbelievable, but it's I think it's going to be ugly. I think Luke Shaw and Juan Bissaka are going to just be pumping in crosses. I think in the first half it's going to look pretty ugly.
Yeah, I think people will underestimate Villarreal. I think they're pretty good defensively. I think they're well organized. I think clearly I mean United should be favorite. They have a very good squad. But they do struggle against low blocks. They do struggle when they have a lot of the ball and they have to create. I mean, Bruno Fernandes has helped that a lot. I think, you know, having Cavani in those type of games helps, right? Because, like, he's good in the air. You can kind of cross into him. He can kind of hold up. He makes those little kind of, like, those little runs. He doesn't need a ton of space. Whereas Martial's injured. Rashford is not amazing. In that, but they've been playing Greenwood there as a 9 instead of Rashford, which I think is better.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do. I think Cavani helps them, has helped them a little bit in that sense of playing against lower blocks. If they start him, I think it'd be an interesting game. I think Villarreal is a cagey team that will make it difficult. They're not going to make it easy. And I think they're smart. I think they'll set up to kind of let United have more of the ball and they'll defend and counterattack. And I wouldn't be surprised to see an upset, but you know, I think United has enough to get it done for sure.
Yeah. I do feel like an upset is more likely in the Europa League game. Like I just feel like City is so much better than Chelsea. Whereas I feel like it's really not that hard to imagine like Harry Maguire, you know, clearly missing someone coming through and Alberto Moreno just burying them. And then, you can just see the story playing out for sure.
Yeah. No Maguire, which he's not.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Is a big hit. They've, they don't have the depth at center back.
It'll be what Tuan Zabi and Lindelof
or Bailey and Bailey has not looked great. He hasn't played a lot. I think that it was a mistake. They've played Maguire too much that they needed those other guys to get more minutes. And like, you know, you have to find ways to get these guys to play so that if you need them. And I think that Maguire, you know, like he just played every game with Lindelof for the most part. And those other guys kind of just languished away and now you need them and they may not be on form. I think, you know, it's a brutal schedule too, right? Like a lot, like with COVID, these players have been playing a ton.
Yeah. You know, United has had just this crazy run of games. Now, you could even argue, though, because their last two games in the league were meaningless, that maybe that was like a little bit of an advantage because it worked out that they were going to get top four regardless. So they've been playing their kids. So, you know, Bruno and Pogba and these guys, they should be very well rested. All right. But yeah, let's get to the meat and potatoes. We got Euro 2021, I think you could say a weird time in world football, because especially European teams, because the great teams of the 2000s and the 2010s are really old now. Spain, very old. Germany, all of their studs have aged out. And they like Germany just, you know, they have 400 guys who are maybe great, but are not great yet, right? So that's very interesting. Portugal. Now, I mean, Ron was benched by Juve in a complete total must win, have to win to get Champions League football game. He was benched for Alvaro Morata like that. I mean, that's the first time I can remember in his career, him not being in there and playing 90 minutes for his team in a must win game. Italy, traditional world power. I mean, they're fine. I don't even like their numbers here. And then the Netherlands, same thing too. Like it's, to me, it is France and England and I guess Belgium and then everyone else. You know, Belgium has their weaknesses as well, but they are pretty strong. But yeah, it is just a very weird time to have Spain, Italy, Germany all not being like truly great teams. Like if there was a World Cup this summer, you'd be worried about Spain like getting through the groups, which is insane.
I think, you know, like, yeah, Spain has gone over a big kind of rework. They had a like ridiculous, I mean, they may have had maybe the best international team ever at their peak, right, with Xavi, Iniesta, Ramos, Pique, all those guys. So, you know, they're due for a drop off. I think there's times when they were really good over this last couple of years with younger players, but the younger players are not at the same standard. And I think that with Luis Enrique, he really just kind of mixes and matches a lot. So I don't think they really know what their best 11 is. And I don't think they have like a set kind of style and system. And there's like a lot of guys that you see on that list that maybe didn't play a ton I don't know how comfortable they are with each other playing. I think they'll be good. I think they'll be better than, I don't think they'll be bad. I think they still have very good players, but like, you know, Thiago, if he's on his game, Fabian Ruiz is very good. Busquets has played really well this season, the second half of the season. Forward wise, I think they're struggling a little bit. Probably, I really like Gerard Moreno. I think he's very good if he starts and plays. I think they would have been a lot better off if they had Ansu Fati, you know, still around.
That's true.
Very that type of player that they needed, like that wide forward. That's kind of
Just someone who can create moments outside of the structure of what you do offensively, like, because the dirty secret about international football is you don't really get to practice that much, and so the international football can just be really boring because the offensive moves are not as drilled, the teammates are just not as used to playing with each other. And one of the big advantages Spain had was everyone played for Barcelona and Real Madrid, and so they were super used to playing with each other. They knew each other's strengths and weaknesses. Like they had partnerships that were there all year round. And so when you lose that, and you are not the most physically talented team anymore, you need someone like Ansu Fati or, you know, whoever to just provide a couple moments of brilliance per game.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I think that is a big difference with international versus club. You're not there every day working with the players. You can't tactically set up the way that you would. And a lot of the managers just aren't as good. Like the best managers usually are going to be in club soccer.
In club soccer.
Yeah. But even then they're out. Even if you're, you know, a top manager, you just don't have the time. The players, you see them every few months and then you see them for a short period of time. Tactically, it's different to set up. I think, you know, a lot of people have romantic views of international football, but like, it's just not as good. It's not. And that's just due to the way it's set up and the nature of it. And this year could be even worse because they have less time to prepare probably.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point is COVID is going to have a big impact. So I think teams with continuity, teams who, you know, aren't going to be shuffling around the lineup, aren't going to be shuffling around formation. You know, I think that those teams are probably going to have an advantage, which is why I think France, who basically they're not going to have anybody new, right? The forwards are going to be Mbappe, Griezmann, and then they will probably rotate that third forward depending on, you know, if it's a super defensive game, they might even play, you know, Moussa Sissoko as one of the forwards, but probably it's going to rotate between Koeman, Benzema, Ousmane Dembele, whatever, and then the defense will be the same. It'll be Varane, it'll be Kimembe, it'll be Pavard, and it'll be Lucas Hernandez. The goalie's not going to change. Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable how good France is as good at international soccer like as USA is at basketball almost.
Well, I will say this: I'm not so high on France on paper.
Okay, let's hear it.
Those reasons that you laid out, I think are their strengths is that they know their squad. They have their team. They just play the same for the most part. Like, I don't think
they play really boring. They play so boring. Yeah.
Yeah. They play boring. It's kind of effective. I don't think Deschamps is a great manager at all. I think that he has so much talent. And I think in the World Cup,
he's the France national manager because he was a great player for the French national team, but no one from League One is trying to hire this dude.
Yeah. I don't think he's a very good manager. I think that he's not super creative. I think he found a system in players that are good and that works and that they were defensive in the World Cup and counterattacking and they had their identity and they knew how to play it and they weren't going to try to, you know, be fancy or do anything too difficult, which is insane because they have so much talent. They could do so much and it would be great to watch, but I don't think they hit their ceiling. I think that you can still be underperforming and win the World Cup, right? Like I think what they did was very good and I think they deserve to win the World Cup. I think that will still carry over, but throughout these qualifiers and stuff, they haven't been super impressive and teams now get to see them a little bit. They get to kind of like, you know, set up against them. And I think that like they should evolve and you have to kind of take another step. I don't think they will. I think taking guys like Sissoko and like Tolisso, who I think is a pretty good player, but he hasn't been playing. But Sissoko is just like, what are you doing? Take Ndombele. Like they didn't even take him and that guy's great. I don't get it.
Yeah, you'd much rather have him in the midfield than
Yeah, I think they're gonna
Sissoko.
Yeah. I think you're gonna have to hit another level, I think. And you wanna have to go out and try to dominate the ball and have possession and a guy like Ndombele can just offer so much, whereas Sissoko just doesn't, I don't think.
Yeah, and I think their biggest competition is England, which, you know, England is always kind of over favored in the betting market. So right now on the FanDuel Sportsbook, France, they're outright for the Euros is +470. Yeah. England is +500. Belgium, we're going to talk about them in a second, are +650. But I think you could say the combination of like tactical solidity, because I love England's tactics for international. 3-5-3 or 3-4-3 is perfect for international football because you have three dudes who know I'm defending, I'm not getting up all game. You'll have one really offensive wing back and then one wing back who does a little bit. And then the way that Gareth Southgate deploys his midfielders is basically they're like water carriers. Like that's their only job. And then the forwards, you know, they also know what they're there for. Like, this is not like France where Deschamps is going to be begging Griezmann to come back and pressure the ball. Right. So it'll be, I guess the problem that England has is trying to give minutes to Mason Mount, Jack Grealish, James Maddison, because the way they set up is they play Declan Rice and Jordan Henderson in the midfield. And probably that actually works best against France and other good teams. But, you know, in some of these group stage games against, you know, Austria, the Czech Republic, whatever, they probably should play one of those very creative young midfielders in central midfield. They should play Grealish over Henderson, Maddison over Henderson. I don't know if Southgate will. I hope he does.
So I have a lot of the same thoughts on England and Southgate that I do on Deschamps. I think that
he's super boring the way he lines
them
up.
He's super boring. I think he's just a coward, man. I think like I'm a purist. Like, I want to see you try to attack at least, especially if you have the talent. Like, England, I mean, you may be able to get results for sure playing very, you know, workmanlike, and there's nothing really wrong with that. But England has so much. England has never had this much talent. They're a super talented side. They have superly creative players. And I don't think that Southgate, you know, has the managerial chops to set them up and to use them. And I think like him icing out Grealish for as long as he did is shows why that's the case. Like, how this guy's been dominating. Like, he should be one of your first players on the score sheet. I think that you have so much attacking talent, you know, and like Foden is amazing.
Foden might not even get a start. Foden might be like the best player on the team that won the EPL and wins the Champions League. Yeah. And he might not even get a start in the Euros.
Yeah. Like, let's play this game. If you had Pep Guardiola in charge of England, right? Like, how would that team look and how would they play? Right.
Well,
now compare that to how Southgate does it from game to game against like Romania, right? Where he's playing two holding midfielders and three center backs. And it's just like, this is blasphemy. Like, what do you think this is? You're robbing the general public of seeing like the sport beautifully played. And you know, they get results, but I don't think at the end of the day that they're doing themselves a favor when it comes to a tournament where you're gonna have to play at a higher level. Your ceiling is going to have to go up to win World Cup.
Yeah, 3-4-3 is not going to work against France. They won't. They just won't be able to score. Like, and he would be so fucked if they didn't have Trippier, Trent Alexander-Arnold, you know, Wan-Bissaka. Like, if they didn't have great offensive fullbacks, it just wouldn't work, because like the whole strength of the team is that he just has these incredibly gifted fullbacks, wingbacks who are, you know, just help him out massively.
And the thing is, when you play the back three, you're taking a midfielder off the pitch, which sometimes is perfectly fine. But when you have that many talented midfielders, when you have Foden, when you have Maddison, when you have Grealish, when you have Sancho, and you're taking off one of those players. So you're taking away your strengths for a weakness, which is like they don't have a ton of great center backs right now. And for me, it's like you want to have as many of your best players on the field, and you have like some amazing midfielders that you should embrace, and you should want to get them all on the field. Like, I think Phillips is very good. I think Rice is very good. I don't necessarily think you should be playing both of them. I think Mount is very good. Like, I kind of trashed Mount for a while because he was being played. I think the managers were playing him like advanced and he wasn't doing a great job. But I think that, you know, since he's been playing for Tuchel, that he has been amazing. And I think you have to play him. So I would rather play, say, like Rice and Mount as an eight, and then like with Grealish, than to have like a back three and two holding midfielders, and you've basically taken off, you know, one of those really good attacking players. I think England should really go for it. I'm not sure they will, and I think they're missing one of their best center backs too, in Tomori for AC Milan, who's been very good. And I think that Southgate is just kind of. Southgate and Deschamps are lazy with their selections. I think they have some good players.
Because England could play like the Barcelona 4-3-3 with with Sterling as one winger, Sancho as the other winger, and then they could just every game he could decide between Mount, Grealish, Foden as the central attacking midfielder, play a double pivot behind them, and at, you know, obviously have four at the back, and he would never do it, but that would be amazing
would
to
be
watch.
I think that would be their. I think that that's going to be their best chance to reach the ceiling of their potential is if you had a base of like Rice and Mount as your kind of two more defensive, with Mount having the freedom to go forward, and then like a Grealish or a Foden, and then you can also rotate Sancho with Foden or with Grealish and play Sterling on the other side, or drop Sterling and play Rashford. Like, you can kind of mix and match with Kane. But I don't think, I'm not sure he'll do it. I mean, he looked like he was doing a little bit more attacking, and I think for them to win, I think they really need to. I think that France and England are poor value, I would say.
Yeah.
From a betting standpoint, I think if I were to make a bet, the best value is Portugal.
Portugal. Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
At 8-1 to win the Euros. Sell me on Portugal.
Well, I think Portugal, they look very good. Their team looked really good. They have some very good young players, like young attacking players. Their system looked solid. They mix and match players. And I want to say like that when they came up against good teams, they've outplayed them over this recent little time. And I'm not even, I think that, you know, when Juve dropped Ronaldo, I think it was the right move. I don't think that Ronaldo was playing well. I think that he doesn't offer enough. I think like defensively he offers like almost nothing. Offensively he scores goals, but he's just the poacher. So you have
he's like the least I've seen this stat bandied about, that like Ronaldo puts like the least on ball pressures of any player in Europe's top five leagues.
Yeah. And not only that, when you win the ball, he's not going to create for you in that sense. Like, he's not going to take the ball and dribble through players anymore. He's not going to like drop into midfield and create. He's not going to take that burden off. Right. So like, as a team, when you're playing with Ronaldo, you kind of have to defensively pick up the slack, and then offensively as well, because you have to have people that are creating on the ball for Ronaldo to get chances. And then when you don't have the ball, you got to do a lot of work to defensively. So like, if you look at Messi, when you have Messi, you have to create, you have to pick up the slack for him defensively, but offensively, just give him the ball. He does everything. And then you can kind of specialize, right? Like, you can have other players kind of like take breaks and not have to expend as much energy. Now with Portugal, I think they're a little bit different. He plays a little bit different. And I would still argue that sometimes they're probably better without him, like when they want to defend more. And I think they played him as a nine, where they don't have to basically have him alongside a nine. So they have someone else that's working hard, that can drop, that can do more, and they can kind of shield him a little bit. I think Portugal has looked very good. And I think that even without him, they look very good. And it's a shame that Pedro Neto is going to be injured, but I really like Diego Jota. I like,
Jota is, I mean, if they do win, he will have like, you know, have scored like six goals and, you know, just been a monster. Cause like he also was like Liverpool's best player. Like he has like more expected goals per minute than Salah. Like, I mean, he can play striker, he can play second striker, he can play left wing. Yeah. I mean, probably their best front line is probably João Felix, Jota, and then, you know, whichever winger you want to put alongside Goncalves
or Neto's Ronaldo, or Ronaldo, right? Which you can play Ronaldo as a nine, or play Ronaldo off the left and play João Felix in the center, and it kind of works. I'm kind of low on Ronaldo in a lot of ways, but I think with Portugal, he's done pretty well. And he, even when he's played as a nine or he's played off the left, they've kind of found a good way to keep their press active, and they've done it well. But when he's not in there, their press is like ridiculous.
Well, and a big problem Portugal does have, though, is they have one all-world amazing center back. They have Ruben Dias, who some people, I think you could argue that he was the best center back in the world over, you know, the post-COVID break, that his addition to the Manchester City lineup is what has coincided with them being so great. But their other options at center back are guys who literally cannot move, like Pepe and Jose Font. They're very good. They're very tactically astute. They are where they need to be. They are communicating constantly to their teammates. but they just cannot move. Like they are just going to get, like, just imagine Jose Font, you know, racing for a loose ball with Mbappe. Like, you know, just these guys are, they're trees.
Okay. So I will say that that is totally accurate. And, but I will say that Pepe was amazing.
Still good. Yeah.
In the Champions League this year against, I believe it was against Juventus, was just like, yeah, the player of the game and was insane. And he was maybe the best center back at one point in the world, like a long time ago. And he was very, yes, good for a long time. And I agree with you, but the guy, look, I mean, that's one position, center back, where you can have an older guy that's intelligent and smart that you can kind of do all right at center back. Like we've seen it before, and he was, you know, very athletic in younger ages, and he's not as athletic anymore. He can't move, but I mean, he's performed really well with Portugal and was amazing with Porto, to the point that it was super surprising to me, but you know, maybe he's got another summer in him, and he's on amazing form, and Ruben Diaz is doing really well. And I think, you know, in soccer, how you play as a unit and how you understand, and if you have like that cohesiveness, especially,
it's very important.
It's super important. Yeah. And they played very well defensively and offensively. And as a unit, Portugal has just looked very good. I think Bernardo Silva has looked very good for them. Andre Silva is on the form of his life right now, playing really well in Germany. Felix hasn't been doing great, but I think he'll pick it up again.
He's actually one of those guys who's better in international soccer than with his club team, almost, because he plays in a very weird role for Madrid, right? Because he plays second striker, and they're not a very creative offensive team, so it just kind of stifles his abilities a little bit. But it, you know, with Portugal, they're like, he's the main distributor, you know, he's the main guy with touches in the final third. So like it does free him up a little bit, I think.
It fits really well. And I think with Atletico, it's, you have to take it with a grain of salt, because there's a lot of good players that have gone there and just haven't played because Simeone is just an animal and he has a specific setup that's,
you gotta do your job or you get subbed out. I mean, they sent Carrasco off to China and then brought him back because he was like, no one can track back and do, like, no one in the world wanted this guy. He goes to China and Simeone says, I got to have him back. Because they tried Thomas Lamar there. They tried Felix on the left. They tried to move Koke to be a wide midfielder, and no one would do what Carrasco did. So they were like, all right, we got to get him back from China.
Yeah. I mean, I always liked Carrasco, and I was like, why is this guy going to China? And he came back and just, as like, they won.
Been amazing.
He's been great, you know, and that's just Simeone. The system is over the players, and he's one of those coaches that his defensive system and his work rate is just way more important than your individual talent.
Yeah. Okay. If I'm gonna tout a long shot, it's Croatia for sure, because they still have the most amazing midfield. The midfield that they are gonna run out is Luka Modric, who is, I think, 35 now. So I think it gets very tough for him to play two games a week, right? It's very hard. It's very hard on his legs. But Luka Modric, when he is 100% good to go and fit, to me, still the best midfielder in the world. Mateo Kovacic, one of the best ball progressors. And he gets no love and respect from EPL fans because he doesn't score and he doesn't really assist either. But he's incredible.
He's been such a good player, and it was hilarious that Lampard was like, this guy's no good. And it's like, what are you, like, you, I'm sorry. No, he's not the type of player that Lampard was. Lampard likes the mounts, right? Like,
yeah, he likes the fox in the box guys, right?
Yeah, and Kovacic is just not that player, but like, he offers so much. He's such a good player.
Yeah, and then
it's nice to see him thrive.
And Brozovic too. I mean, Brozovic is, as your defensive midfielder, going to progress the ball, going to recycle the ball, like very good at pressures per 90.
Yeah.
Now their forwards, they're all various degrees of disappointing, right? Rebic, you know, got replaced by 39-year-old Zlatan Ibrahimovic at AC Milan. Kramaric, I guess, is good. Kramaric had a very good season for Hoffenheim. But it's for me, it's hard to figure out, you know, Bundesliga forwards. It's like, you know, you're playing against teams that have like a $6 million payroll half the weekends.
Let me see who their forwards are here. Yeah. So I'm really high on Kramaric. I think Kramaric is actually under undervalued.
He's a fantasy god. He is in the Bundesliga. He's unbelievable.
He is. Yeah. And I think, but like defensively, he can play a lot of positions. He pressures well. I think that if Croatia could get the best out of him, they could go far. I think they need to get their forward. They need to get a lot of forward productivity. And I think you need to utilize Kramaric to do that. And maybe Perisic can turn the years back. Perisic is still a decent player.
Well, he just should only start every other game. I just can't. So they will probably rotate him and Pickle, Nikola Vlasic, who plays for CSKA Moscow and Russia. Those guys will probably rotate. I mean the problem that Croatia has is they have Simi Vrsaljko, who's like a good right back, but like then basically everyone else they have who plays on defense either plays domestically in Croatia or plays in Russia. And Borna Barisic plays in Scotland for Rangers, but they just are. I mean, it feels odd that you would have some of the best midfielders ever, right? Luka, yeah. Rakitic, Perisic, like these incredible, amazing ball progressing midfielders. And you can't come up with one all world defender in a generation. It's kind of like the Messi problem for Argentina.
Well, I mean, if you look at Croatia, it's just amazing that they produce as much talent as
like 800,000 people or something like that.
It's a tiny country. Like they're just minuscule. So I guess it makes sense that they have some, you know, holes they can't fill. Cause like, let's be honest, their defense sucks. Like they still play Vida quite often.
They still play Dejan Lovren, who's like 6 years past his best at this point.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like internationally, you just don't have a chance. You don't have a choice sometimes. Sometimes you got like some world-class players playing beside complete dumpster fires and you just can't.
Yeah, it is. That is
a tiny country.
It's amazing. It's nothing else exists like this in sports where like Messi will be lining up in you know for the Argentina national team next to some midfielder who plays for Independiente and is 32 and has never been to, it's like unreal some of the dynamics you get in international football like that.
I will say that the soccer world is very Euro-centered and there is a lot of very good players in South America that play in Argentina that play maybe in Brazil that don't maybe they don't come over to Europe but like there's a breeding ground of super talented players. Now, Argentina as a national team is a dumpster fire because they're, you know, run terribly. But, you know, there's still a lot of really good talented players. I mean, Croatia, like, for example, I would say, right, like, those players are getting scouted. So,
yes.
If you're pretty good, you're probably going to go over there. I think that they're – if I had to pick – I think that you when you have a very good midfield – like Croatia has with
that's the number one thing in international soccer.
Yeah, you can carry a lot. You can carry a lot because, and we saw that with the last World Cup, right? Like Croatia had, you know, Rakitic, Brozovic, and Modric. And those guys were like a little bit old, but they carried the team because they're just,
you just have the ball the whole game. Have unlimited chances because you have the ball, you're connecting passes to your teammates. And that's a huge advantage.
Yeah, it's like your cerebral, you know, your cerebral system, your brain, everything is dictated from your midfield. So you got a really good midfield, you got intelligent midfielders, you can paper over some cracks, and you know, management is dumbed down in international. So Croatia is always going to have a chance. I'm not sure that this time. I think that this time they're a little bit older. It's going to be difficult, but I do really like. Their midfield, and if Kramaric gets it going and they utilize him well in Vlasic, they could do some damage. I think there's some very good teams though. I think there are some really good teams looking at it. I think Portugal plays very well. Of course, France. Of course, England. I really like Belgium. I think Belgium is maybe underpriced.
Yeah, Belgium to me, I think should be priced ahead of England because like if you just go position by position, their center backs, you know, so Alderweireld would start for England. Now, yeah. I don't know if, you know, Boyata or Vertonghen at this stage in their career would start for England and they run the back three.
Definitely wouldn't probably.
Yeah. And they run the back three system as well, but they do it in a non-cowardly way. because their wingbacks are actually attackers. You know, they will start, you know, Carrasco will be one of the wingbacks. Nasser Chadli will be one of the wingbacks. Thorgan Hazard will be one of the wingbacks. They've even gone in the qualifiers one game. They even went more attacking than that. They started Dries Mertens as one of the wingbacks behind the three forwards, which is like insanely attacking. I guess if you were going to criticize them, you'd say when they use Michy, Benteke, or Lukaku as the strikers, those guys play such a different style than the rest of the team. Like, I mean, obviously Lukaku, great striker. Even Benteke, I mean, what, he just scored 8 goals for like one of the worst offensive teams in the Premier League. Like, these guys can score, but they play in a much different style than all the rest of their teammates do with their clubs.
Yeah. I think, Belgium, it's the back three works for them. They, one of the reasons I like them is they have a set style that they know. They have the same players that have been playing together for a while. They have a system that they use, that they're drilled on, that they know it very well. And it works for them specifically because you have De Bruyne and Lukaku and Hazard when he was on form. He's not been great, but they kind of play this weird system where they kind of give up possession and create a lot of space to get on the counter, even with a very attack-minded team. And Lukaku is not amazing with his back to goal, but is amazing like when he's got space to run at you. Like, he just crushes teams like that. So I think that it works for them, right? Like that's the best way to get out of Lukaku. It's not going to be when you have a low block, right? Like playing against a low block, Lukaku is not really going to thrive. He's going to kind of not be at his best. But
well, it's just going to be a lot of Thomas Meunier crosses towards his forehead that are not high expected goal plays at all.
Yeah, and then even sense, right? Like, Lukaku is this really big guy that looks like a target 9, right? But like, that's not really the way that he plays.
No, he's better with the ball at his feet, turning around.
Yeah, exactly. He's better when he's like, he can run at you, and he uses his size, his strength, and his intelligence to score a lot of goals that way, as opposed to just looking at him like, he's big. He looks like a Drogba, but he's not. Like, he's not like a great guy in the air. Like, that's not necessarily his strong point. His strong point is kind of playing in a different style. And the way that Belgium plays really plays to that strength. And it also plays to De Bruyne, because when De Bruyne has, you know, space to run into on the break, he's just going to make the best decisions. And he's going to make great passes, and he's going to basically find passing lanes, and he's going to find through balls. And the way that they play with the back three, where they basically give up a little bit of possession, but then play really attacking when they get the ball, really works for them. It's kind of very similar to how AC Milan plays, in that kind of a 3-5-2.
Yeah.
And it makes sense that Lukaku thrives in that system perfectly, I think. And I think that, you know, I think they're a little underpriced. I think that they have more of an understanding of what they're going to do. And I think they're dangerous. I think they could kind of give anybody a tough game.
Yeah. I think I'm going to bet Belgium and Croatia, and then I'm going to think about adding Portugal, because we got to have a little bit to sweat. Before we get out of here, though, I want to talk some crypto, because obviously you are big in the space. We talked a little bit about crypto when the prices were much lower, although the prices are closer to where they were 10 months ago than we both would have liked. So the big question I have, and I'm just always fascinated by people's individual answers for this, because we've seen so many people who were Bitcoin bulls for forever, right? For the last 5 years, 6 years, just I'm buying Bitcoin, yeah. I'm dollar cost averaging, I'm never selling it, I'm holding it. And I would say last 4 months, I've just seen a big flippening of people's stances and attentions, right? I don't foresee a near future where Bitcoin and Ethereum's prices truly flip, or where ETH is worth, you know, 0.1 BTC or anything like that. But personally, I seeing real world actual applications of these smart contracts has been very eye-opening for me. So I'm just kind of wondering your perspective on, you know, Ethereum and how your attitude towards it has changed.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, like I've been in crypto for a while, and I really started like kind of digging and learning a lot more recently over this last year, since we last talked probably. And, you know, I think that I think Bitcoin still has a very, you know, strong value proposal, and it has a place in space. I think Bitcoin is more important, like geopolitically. I think, you know, in terms of maybe replacing the reserve currency. And when you have more geopolitical kind of strife and like two superpowers in like China and United States kind of jostling, that maybe having the reserve currency of the world being not tied to a specific government that can control it is probably better. And it's safer for a lot of countries like maybe Argentina or something else where their currency is getting debased and there's a lot of difficulties. So like that makes a lot of sense, right? But when you look at Ethereum, I think Ethereum is a productive asset, right? Like Ethereum, you can build tons of stuff on it. It's basically like internet 2.0 is being built on Ethereum. You can program it to do anything. You can use it for DeFi. You can use it to park it to get a loan. You can use it to stake it. And its use case is not just that, like, hey, this is going to be valuable and the number is going to go up and I'm going to hold on to this. It's like, actually, companies can build on it on the Ethereum network. They can transact on it. There is, within DeFi, there is so much cool stuff happening and so much like innovation happening that is just not happening on Bitcoin. It can't really be built on Bitcoin. I think Ethereum just has, like, I think that, you know, the argument for Bitcoin is that it's a store of value, right? Which is a strong argument, and it's just important, right? So like you could say it would eat into the market cap of gold. The argument for Ethereum is this is basically internet 2.0, and you can build whatever you want on it. You can like create a decentralized internet and you can program it to do whatever you want. I just think that that is a better argument and that's easier to sell. You don't have to have a government be, you don't have to basically say to a government, this is going to replace you, replace your central bank. You could just say to companies, be like, hey, look, come build on this. Come use this, play with this. If you're a bank, you could say, hey, like we can cut out a ton of redundancies. And I just think that that is, has more ways to win. I think Ethereum has more ways to win in the long run and get taken up than maybe Bitcoin, which has like a very kind of a little bit more narrow of an argument to make.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Bitcoin argument, there are kind of two prongs, right? So one is it replaces US dollars, the petrodollar, as the reserve currency. Maybe when I was 25, I believed that. I'm much more cynical now, and I see that as being very unlikely. That doesn't mean that I'm a Bitcoin bear though, because the bear case, the more realistic bear case for Bitcoin, I think, is what we're starting to see a little bit, which is large financial institutions and corporations begin to hold Bitcoin as a reserve currency as they realize the inflation of the US dollar. And it's kind of a hedge against the US dollar, right? So obviously the Tesla thing is well publicized, but you know, MicroStrategy with Sailor, Square, and owns some, I believe PayPal owns some as well. I think that's, we're just going to see that. I actually saw a report like 2 weeks ago that Mark Zuckerberg owns the single largest stash of Bitcoin in the world now, because he's just been buying. Now Facebook doesn't own any of it, but basically a wallet that people think that is Zuckerberg's has accumulated like $10 billion worth of Bitcoin. You know, there's the Novogratz stuff where basically Mark Novogratz runs a Bitcoin trust, which just buys Bitcoin for rich people and saves it for them. And to me, that just seems so much more realistic than the US dollar capitulates and we replace it. But that's a very real use case, right? It's like digital gold. And so weird, I happened to see someone tweeting about the Bitcoin white paper the other day, and I went back and I read the first couple pages, and it is funny that a lot of the Bitcoin bros, you know, talk about Satoshi's vision and everything. Yeah. And, you know, store of value really was not part of it when he wrote it. Now, he did talk about that on the forums and stuff, and people have all those forum posts saved and everything. But it is fascinating to see that basically the huge value in Bitcoin has not become peer-to-peer digital cash. It's been, there's only 21 million. Like that's the use case, is only 21 million.
Yeah, and that's the use case. And so like all these arguments that, you know, companies are putting it on the balance sheet, Michael Saylor, all these guys, that gets a little bit more precarious after this weekend, you know, like the price went completely to shit, all of crypto, right? But, you know, companies are just going to have a hard time stomaching and making that argument when that volatility hits and it crashes. And it's just like, why do you want to take on that risk? If it, and it takes that to get to like adoption, but like if that's the only use case and that's the only argument and we're putting it all on that, that is a volatile path to go down, I would say. Not to say that it wouldn't work, and I'm very still bullish on Bitcoin. I just think like with Ethereum, it's like we don't need to have that argument that you have to put, you can basically, a company can put it on their balance sheet to actually use it and develop it and use it and make things from it. And that's just a better argument, I think, that is easier to sell, that all this volatility, you could say, well, with Ethereum, with smart contracts, you can do all this stuff. DeFi has billions of dollars locked up, right? Like, and it's innovating like really interesting things. And I think at the end of the day, if you're gonna make an argument and you're gonna sell it to the business world, right? And in institutions, you could say, okay, if you're Chase and you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of employees and you have how much money locked, and then you can look at a DeFi platform that has 15 employees and has $40 billion locked and their revenue, that's just going to always be the final answer for businesses, right? Like they're always going to be like, hey, I can cut out all these redundancies and basically utilize smart contracts and cut out all this waste. And that's always going to be an answer that they're always going to gravitate towards, regardless of, like, that's just going to be, that's just going to always happen. I don't think that's necessarily great for the labor force. And there's different ways that you have to kind of solve that for sure. Like that can't just be an issue that's just swept under the table. But I think that that is the final answer. And I think we're more likely to get there than we are to basically like try to sell Bitcoin on future, on, you know, on adoption. And we've ridden Bitcoin a couple cycles in crypto, and you know, it's volatile and it's boom or bust. And it would just be nice if we could kind of all maybe separate it a little bit, and Ethereum could have its own use case driven and Bitcoin could have its own, and then it could kind of like both be, you know, good going forward, but maybe not tied to each other as much. You know, I'm a big Ethereum. I've switched over a lot to Ethereum. And actually to Matic as well, to Polygon.
Yeah, and one of the other big things is because Ethereum, like there's an Ethereum foundation, right? There is Vitalik, yeah. and crypto bros like don't like that, right? Like the centralization and everything. But when you're talking about government legislation, tax rates, regulation, the federal governments are going to find that so much more palatable, right? They're going to view the Ethereum network and the protocol as much more understandable and much more, legislatable than Bitcoin transactions. Like I just think that's just true.
Yeah. And I think that we're not going to be able to get away from this narrative of Bitcoin's energy use. Like that's kind of out there.
No, it's here to stay, even if it's kind of bullshit.
Exactly. Even if it's bullshit, it's still going to be used against us. Right. And I hate Elon, and I can't stand the guy and like how he's kind of played this, but you know, there is truth that it is taking a lot of energy, that a lot of it is bullshit. But if you're going to run that narrative, you know, Ethereum isn't held to that. They can basically, they're going to, in the summer, right, they're going to decrease their energy usage, and it's already a lot lower.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, and maybe I'll try and get one of these libertarian Bitcoin bros like Nick Carter or something on the show to come do a whole thing about the Bitcoin energy. So I guess what I kind of had to go through this transition stage where I was like, look, I'm not going to sell my Bitcoin. I'm not going to trade it in for Ethereum. But what I have done is just more of my USD weekly buys are going into Ethereum than ever before. Cause I do think the future of decentralized finance is, I mean, the $80 billion is nothing. Like, do you know how much transactional volume goes through the stock market or traditional banks on a given day. Like it's not even begun. Like we're still in the dugout slapping each other's asses, in the words of Peter Overzet. Like it's just beginning.
Yeah, it's just, I wish I would have got into DeFi like last summer. I was a little bit late.
Yeah.
And I just remember hearing all about it, but I was still kind of like not, I was still a little PTSD from 2017, 2018 in crypto. So it took me a little while longer, but I've kind of jumped in now, and it's really interesting and it's cool. And there's a lot of stuff to learn. And I mean, there's a lot of innovation happening on a few different chains. And I think, you know, I would advise anybody that is interested in that stuff, or anybody from the gambling space, to just kind of check it out. Because in terms of like from gambling as well, it is like,
it's amazing. Yeah.
It's the most degen thing you could do, really. I mean, it's the swings in DeFi and in crypto can be gut-wrenching, to say the least.
Yeah, they're huge.
And I will say that I've basically converted most of my Bitcoin over. And I don't hate Bitcoin. I still have a lot of, you know, love for it. And I still think that it serves a purpose, but I want productive assets a little bit more. And
so yeah. Yeah. That's a big thing. Yeah, yeah. Productive assets. And, you know, it's easier to lend Ethereum. Yeah. Like if it, you know, and like I had some Bitcoin on BlockFi for a while, really, it's just centralized lending. Really BlockFi is just traditional finance, but using a crypto asset like a mask, basically. Like it's me lending it to BlockFi, who lends it to someone else. Like it's not the heart of what DeFi is at all.
Yeah. And you can convert, you know, you can convert that Bitcoin onto wrapped Bitcoin and put it on Ethereum and use it on Ethereum network too. I mean, it's not true Bitcoin, but I mean, that's a good way to kind of dip in.
I mean, that is so that right there. I mean, that's a potential $1 billion idea, is figuring out a way to let people yield farm their Bitcoin without wrapping it.
That's coming out right now. So Thorchain, Rune, which is like I own some, is it's gonna be like a truly decentralized multi-chain platform. And it's already just rolling out, so you can still kind of do it, but it's still in the beta phase. But if you wanted to look into, I would look into Thorchain, Rune, because that is basically what they're doing. And I think that'll be like a massive use case, that people can keep their Bitcoin and use it decentrally on a multi-chain platform.
Yeah. All right. Well, there we go. Great show. Paul, thank you very much for chatting. Everyone, you can find Paul in the FanDuel and DraftKings soccer lobbies. Pew, pew, pew. You can follow him on Twitter. Has a lot of good little nuggets here and there. And the show will be back next week.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.